When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's wintertime. When temperatures go down, the likelihood goes up that your furnace and other appliances go down with them. So don't risk a costly replacement. Stay comfortable with coverage on the appliances you depend on most with the Service Guard Appliance Repair Program from Black Hills Energy. It's peace of mind in a plan. Visit blackhillsenergy.com/signup to learn more.
At Baker's, no matter where you order free pickup, you get the same great deals as you'd get in-store. So you can save when you order during band practice or at the dog park or wherever. Start your cart with the Baker's app and save from wherever today. Baker's, fresh for everyone. $35 order minimum. Restrictions may apply. Subject to availability.
Get more ways to save at the buy five or more, save $1 each sale. Just buy five or more participating items and save $1 each with card. Baker's, fresh for everyone.
Listening to the Career Musician Podcast with creator and host Nomad. With 20 plus years of experience in the music industry, Nomad has done just about everything to earn a living as a career musician. From being music director to celebrity artists, playing iconic arenas and stadiums, composing for film and TV, and even playing your average local club gigs, he's done it all. Nomad's mission is to empower musicians across the globe with strategies for a sustainable career while blasting stereotypes, and to bring you tried and true wisdom from his colleagues in this crazy business we call music.
Mr. Derek Jones from Megatrax. Now, if you haven't heard, Megatrax is a production music library based out here in Los Angeles, California. If you're not familiar with production music libraries, then Google it, because you should be as a career musician. And if you're not a career musician and you're just listening for fun, well, basically, a production music library provides catalogs in large volume of what we call underscore or music cues. And now this is the music that oftentimes you hear under the dialogue in some of your favorite movies and TV shows. Well, Megatrax literally is mega. They are a ginormous company and they have thousands, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of different cues and songs and so forth by a plethora of composers and artists. Now, Derek Jones is the man behind the curtain. He runs their multi-million dollar studio facility and is in charge of quite a number of the productions that Megatrax puts out. I will let Derek tell you himself. Trust me, this man is extremely knowledgeable with a vast skill set that runs the gamut from production, composing, mixing, engineering, and so forth. Check it out right here on the Career Musician Podcast. So welcome to the Career Musician.
Thank you.
And you are, by title, engineer, producer, XYZ, what else? How do you describe yourself?
My official job title is Director of Creative Services and Production / Chief Engineer / Producer.
Now that is impressive.
Yeah, I got slashes, but
I love
I'm a slashy.
Okay, that's funny. I could.
What ended up happening just through time, being at the same studio, I've kind of assimilated jobs or positions into my position. And so, but they're different enough that the title came with it. So, you know, I was an assistant engineer and then graduated to like first engineer, or second engineer, first engineer. And then the chief engineer of the studio retired. And so I kind of just became chief engineer. But in addition to doing all of that, I started to create a catalog for the company that I work for. And I started to do all that sort of stuff. So that's where the producer comes in. But then I also kind of oversee and wrangle all the cats for the owners of the company for their albums that they do. So that's where the director of production and creative services, because I also do, like, I also oversee custom stuff when custom stuff comes in. So
right. And you've asked me, you've spearheaded a couple projects that I've done, but you approached me.
Yeah.
Are we allowed to divulge the name of the company you work with?
Yeah, I mean, we can.
Okay.
So, it's a company called Megatracks Production Music, and we make music for licensing and TV and film. So we don't score, like a lot of musicians are like, oh, so you score films or you score, and it's, we don't score. What we do is we record the music ahead of time in hopes that somebody will have a use for it later. So if you think like John Williams writes the score to a movie, but in one scene, the actors go into a nightclub, they're not going to have John Williams try to write EDM music, you know, and oh, so yeah. We have albums of EDM music. We literally do every style of music.
That's right. You do.
It's crazy. It's,
we just did a hybrid flamenco project together. Yeah.
Yep.
So, and I mean, that's just one out of, like you said, hundreds of genres.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons why I like working there. When I first moved out to LA, I was looking at different studios to work at. Well, originally when I moved out to here to LA, I was trying to be a like a touring musician. I'm a drummer, actually.
Okay, that was one of my questions. Yeah. What's your principle? Okay.
And it's just funny how life kind of keeps coming back around and smacking you in the face. So,
isn't it, though?
Since high school, I've always, being the drummer, you have to get the microphones to record your drums when you're in the band. And, you know, the singer just shows up with the one microphone and the guitarist will either plug in direct through their little, you know, whatever Boss pedal they have or whatever, know. This is back when, like, Tascam Porta Studios on, you know, cassette four tracks were
a thing. I have one in the garage.
Amazing. And, you know, we were all recording little demos to in high school to get gigs. And so I ended up having to learn how to record my drums. And I was blessed to go to an amazing high school, a public high school in Massachusetts that had a phenomenal music program. We had a music wing of the high school. And the band room was big enough to, the band room was so big that we had our marching band drum line set up all the time. And then we had our entire orchestra set up. And then we had our entire jazz big band set up in an arc around, because it was set up like, it was set up, you know, like a orchestra style where it kind of arcs around the room.
It's incredible. And there, where was
tiers.
This?
It was a little tiny town called Lynnfield, Massachusetts.
Okay. So we
it's about 20
this.
Minutes north of Boston, but a lot of sports players live there. Like a lot of the Boston Red Sox live there. A lot of the Boston Bruins live there.
Wow.
And so the town has a lot of money.
That's
but
cool.
In the 60s, they built a new high school and the music program was always really strong there. And they decided to spend in, this is like in 1965 or 68, I think they spent something like $250,000 or $350,000 building the band room. It's all acoustically designed. It had acoustic panels on the wall. It had these huge 8-foot diameter convex sound clouds that hung at different levels. It basically was like a second gymnasium. So imagine a high school gym, but converted into a music room.
Into a
studio. The floor had these the floor was like a normal floor, but then halfway there were these concrete risers that they built into the floor. So you had, like, instead of having wooden risers that you set up on, you know, so that the percussion is up at the back. And these were, like, they framed it and poured the concrete, and built these concrete tiers that were about 4 or 5 feet deep. And they arced around the entire one side of the one half of the room.
So they built staging into the room, basically.
Yeah, I mean,
it has its own staging.
It was pretty amazing. Yeah. And then we had like a wing that the band room was attached to, where we had our own classrooms. We had our own lockers for our instruments, practice rooms. We had like 4 practice rooms with pianos in them and stuff. It was like a kind of reminded me of like a little mini Berkeley.
That's cool.
But
it was phenomenal. Good memory, by the way, to recall all this with such detail.
Oh, dude, I spent most of my high school in there. We could get a pass from the music teacher. If we had study hall, we could go to the band room and then we would just practice. So I started to record demos. I asked the band director if I could, because it just sounded amazing in there. I mean, it was all acoustically tuned and everything. It was phenomenal. And so I brought my drums into the high school and set up the 4-track and started recording my drum set in the big band room during like study hall and stuff like that. And then I started experiment moving mics around, and then I started moving my drum set around, and I just started getting into sound and, you know, how sound works.
Sure. So your brain was already on this engineer tip.
Yeah.
Well before you might have even been aware of it. It just kind of happened intuitively.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it kept coming back. It was like a reoccurring theme. You know, I would give somebody a tape, be like, hey, man, check out my playing. You know, I'd love to work for you. I'd love to work with you and be in your band. You know, like when I'm trying to, like, you know, between high school and college and trying to, you know, get gigs in college. They'd be like, yeah, drumming's pretty good. But man, who recorded that? It's phenomenal. I need to record. And I'm like, yeah, I did. But, you know, I really want to play. Well, I already have a drummer, but, you know, I need somebody to record. And it's like, okay, I guess I could record. You know, I had to record a scholarship tape to get a scholarship to go to Berkeley. And you know, everybody, even halfway through going to Berkeley, people, teachers and things like that, when I was taking MP&E classes, they would listen to this and be like, who recorded this? And I'm like, I did.
Wow.
They're like, what console did you record through? None. It was just straight into the Tascam. And like, it sounds phenomenal. Like, you know, and no EQ, no nothing. And it really kind of taught me from an early age that, you know, acoustics kind of trumps everything else. Like, we can, I mean, I love gear and I'm not knocking any gear, but you know, there's the right tool for every job. But, if it's crap in, you're just polishing turd. So, you know, getting it to sound right before it hits the microphone, and when it hits the microphone, is kind of the most important thing. But anyway, so just, you know, I started off as a performance major in college, and then halfway through, I wanted to switch to, MP&E, which is music production and engineering.
Thank you.
And, I went to the dean of that department, and he was like, yeah, we'd love to have you. Your grades are great. It's a solid 3 years of classes for this major. And I was talking to him in my like fifth semester, I think.
This is at Berkeley.
At Berkeley. So I would have been at Berkeley for 6 years. And I was like, there is no way I'm going to college for 6 years. So he recommended I do this thing called professional music, which is technically what I got my major in. And professional music, I believe they still have it at the school, but it was kind of like a choose your own major. You got to basically pick and choose. You sat down with the department head and you said, this is ultimately what I want to do in the music business or in the music industry, whatever it is. You know, it could be anything. And then you and the head of the department come up with your own curriculum based on that. And the department head, the guy's name at the time, I believe, was Ken Brass. He would talk to the other department heads and get you waivers so that you wouldn't have to meet all the prerequisites to take certain classes that you might need.
Nice.
So I was able to take, I mean, I didn't get to do the full MP&E program, but I got to take some music production and engineering classes. I got to take music business classes. I got to take arranging and orchestration classes. You know, I got to kind of take a gamut. My goal was engineering was a thing that like I did, but it wasn't like the thing I wanted to do. I really wanted to be a producer. And I always liked the idea that, you know, especially when you're a musician, you're always kind of going around trying to find somebody that needs work and needs you to work for them. And
yes.
I always wanted to be the guy that created the work could hire other people to do it.
Okay, hold on. I got to interject because one of the discussion topics is words of wisdom. Listen, everybody out there, that's a gem right there. If you're sitting here saying to yourself, oh my gosh, if I can only get a gig, I need more work. Well, that is it. You have to be in a position to create the work.
Yeah.
And that was very insightful of you. Yeah. So this is in college.
Yep.
So at a young age, you know, were privy to this.
Yeah, I noticed it. You know, yeah. You could see it. Everybody runs into it and they see it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some guys go the route, well, I want to start my own band because that's mm-hmm. the way I can then generate work. And I did that too. I mean, okay. I started a band with a few friends of mine, and then they eventually kicked me out of the band because they wanted to do more gigs in New York, and I was living in Boston, and so I was driving from Boston,
yeah, that's a lot of
to New York on like a Tuesday night to play like the 19th hole at midnight, and then driving back the same night. And then having to go to my day job the next day. This was after I graduated Berkeley. Ooh. So it was getting rough. And and so then they were like, yeah, well, you know, we took a vote and we're going to switch to using this guy in New York City. So I was like, whatever, man. Okay. Yeah, so
at that point, you're over.
Yeah. And then I started another group that was just going to be like almost like a casuals band. Like in Boston, there's a huge college scene there. I think I read once that there's more colleges per square foot in Boston, Massachusetts than anywhere else in the world.
Wow.
Like there's little tiny colleges and then there's big universities. Sure. And I mean, it's a huge college town. So there's a lot of live music. There's a lot of kids that like to go out and party. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's still this way, but, you know, 20-30 years ago, bands could make a lot of money playing at the bigger bars and nightclubs, but you had to do cover songs. Sure. And it had to be kind of pop rock music. And, you know, so a lot of the guys that I went to school with, they were really focused on doing original music and honing their craft as musicians and artists. And I was like, forget that, man. I just want to make some money. You know, I'd rather play music making money than, you know, sitting at a desk staring at spreadsheets. But
and then go practice at home. Yeah, that's right. That's
and
right.
So so I was like, you know, I started a band that was just going to be cover songs and just to try to play like the big club circuit. And then I ended up moving out here as I was putting that together, and I moved out to LA. So I never really got that completely off the ground. But
so you land foot here. Mm-hmm. What was next? What happened?
You know, the first thing I did when I moved out here, I through the Berkeley Alumni Network, I got a job teaching music at teaching drum set lessons at a youth center in South Central LA called A Place Called Home. And
cool.
It's a phenomenal place. It's still there.
That's awesome.
You know, they have an amazing arts program. When I was there back in the early 2000s, Dr. Dre, Suge Knight, Will Smith, they donated a ton of money to create the music program. Janet Jackson donated a ton of money to create the dance program.
That's cool.
It's free for any kids 18 and under. And it's open all day. They serve food all day for the kids. There's a lot of kids that go there that are homeless. There were a lot of kids that would try to get locked into the bathrooms at night so that they wouldn't have to sleep on the streets. And you know what? These kids are just so amazing.
Like, is at home? What is it?
A Place Called Home.
A Place. Okay.
And it's in South Central.
Yeah.
But there it is.
Excellent.
But phenomenal place. It had a tie-in with Berklee College of Music for a while. It still might. But we were, for the kids that really excelled in our music program, Berklee would offer them partial tuition scholarships and some full scholarships to the summer program. So they could go to Berklee for the 5-week summer program and experience that. And then if they wanted to go to college there, they could apply for scholarships and, you know, try to get scholarships as well.
Very cool. And this is just APCH.org for our listeners. A Place Called Home. HPCH.org.
Yeah, APCH. Yep. So phenomenal organization. I worked there for a few years, but after working there for about 6 months, I ended up, I was applying at studios. You know, it's funny because I thought to myself, well, I know how to do sound engineering. And
it's a good plus.
If I can get a gig, a buddy of mine worked at a record label out here. And he said, you know, I was talking to this drummer and he was in one of the bands that got signed to our record label. And he said that he got the gig with the band just because he was an assistant engineer at the studio that they were trying to record at. And after they fired their drummer, you know, he was just talking to them. So I was like, maybe I should try to get a gig as an assistant engineer out here. So I started applying at different studios and I was looking at different studios. And one of the studios I applied to was this place called Megatrax, and they had they do this thing that I'd never heard of before called library music.
Right.
I didn't know anything about it.
This was circa...
This was 2001.
Wow, okay, yeah. Cool.
I moved here December 18th of 2000. So, okay. And then right around May of 2001, I got the job over at Megatrax. So
you went and you heard about it. Yep. You inquired.
I found out about it actually through the Berklee Alumni Network.
Oh, okay. Berklee, again, they have a strong alumni.
You know, it's crazy. Yes. I can trace every gig I've ever gotten or every dollar that I've ever made in the music industry back to going to that school.
Amazing.
So
that's testament to the fact that it's worth it.
You know, I mean, when you look, when I was looking at schools to go to, this is for the, I guess, the younger listeners, if there's kids out there that are listening to this. When I was in high school and I was trying to find what college to go to, I wanted to go to music school. I knew that. Right. And I started looking at the career placement rates of graduates. That's a statistic that most colleges have to report. And, you know, I was looking at, you know, like University of North Texas and NYU, you know, Tisch inside NYU has a School of Music and Eastman School of Music and UMiami and a lot of them, their placement rate, their you know, the within 5 years after graduation, it was usually around 20 to 25% of the graduates had a job in the field that they got their major in.
Okay.
Berklee's was 86% at that time. I imagine it's probably higher now. So,
and
this
down.
Is this isn't Berklee, California. This is Berklee School of Music, with two E's. Yeah, Berklee. So, I was like, okay, well, that is a really strong motivation to go there.
Yes.
And then after going through the school, you start to realize that, you know, the alumni, just like with Harvard or MIT or, you know, Yale, the alumni all stick together. It's almost like we all went through the same boot camp, you know, so we all know kind of the same musical language. We all know what we all had to go through. And so you kind of know, you know what to expect, at least, you know, when you, when you're working with somebody that went somewhere else, you don't know, you know, what they went through and what classes they were required to take and what they didn't, you know, stuff like that. So, but, yeah, I can trace pretty much every gig, including, you know, the album that I got nominated for a Grammy for, all the way back to going to Berklee. So, you know, it's kind of a prop to the school, but.
Excellent. That's, hey, it's a good.
Yeah, prop. I was glad. I was, when I was walking around, I went to some other universities around the country. I won't say which ones, but I was just floored. I would walk into their music school. And this is what I heard. It was dead.
Silence.
Silent. And I can remember waiting to take one of the entrance exams. You know, you had to do like a music theory test. And I'm waiting outside to take a music theory test. And there was a kid playing bass, like electric bass, just kind of noodling and practicing scales and stuff in the hallway and at one of these other schools. And one of the teachers walked by and told him to stop.
Oh, come on.
And said that he was disturbing the classrooms.
But that's what you're there to do.
And then you go to Berklee College of Music.
And that's all you hear.
And there is music coming from that school 22 hours a day. They shut it down from 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. in the morning so that the cleaning crews can go through and clean.
Really?
But there is music happening 22 hours every day of the week from 8 a.m. to 6 a.m. every day.
That's incredible.
everywhere. I mean, you go down by the mailboxes, there's all these kids with drum practice pads, because the height, like, you know, you take a couple steps down to get to the mailboxes. So if you turn around and put a chair down, floor is the perfect height to practice on. There's everybody has guitars everywhere. Yeah, everybody's right. Singing in the hallways everywhere they go. You know, all the vocalists are always practicing singing as they're walking around. So music just comes at you from everywhere. You're hearing music come out of every classroom, cool. Bands performing, teachers playing examples. And so that's one of the things that really drew me to it. But awesome. I'm going off on tangents now. But
That's brilliant. I love it.
So through the Berklee Alumni Network, they had a job posting for an assistant engineer at Megatracks. And so I went over there to interview. And it was really cool. The thing that I really liked about it, I get bored very easily. Mm. And that was one of the things that I always had a problem with being in a band. You know, being in a band and you're playing the same set or the same two sets over and over and over, and then you practice them over and over and over. And one of the cool things when I was doing the interviews at Megatracks was that they do all different styles of music, and it's always different every week. So one week you're doing heavy metal, the next week you're doing big band jazz, the next week you're doing a string quartet, the next week you're doing salsa music. It's always different, it's always changing. And so that really appealed to me. So I applied and I went through the process, and they have a big process that you usually go through to try to get a job there. It's not just like an interview and you shake a hand. It's like they sit you down in front of an editing system and they're like, okay, we need you to edit this stuff. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sit you down in front of a Pro Tools system. Okay. Set up a recording session and put the headphone sense on this and do this. And, you have to kind of know your stuff, and they have tests that you had to do to prove that.
Sure.
And so I did all of those. But the funny thing is, the chief engineer told me this years later, but the reason why, or he says, maybe it's jokingly, but it's kind of a good story. He said the reason why I got the gig over everybody else that applied, he is a big fan of the Microsoft Logitech trackball, where you use your thumb to move the trackball, and then you use your fingers to click, instead of like the Kensington, which is like the huge ball where you use your fingers.
I have the Kensington, yeah.
I have carpal tunnel syndrome from trying to do drum corps. And I got really, really bad carpal tunnel syndrome. And so I had trouble using a mouse. And so I always had that Microsoft Logitech with the trackball.
With the thumb trackball.
And so every guy that came in to interview and sat down and went to do the test, they just couldn't figure out how to use the trackball. I was the only guy that walked in and sat down and was like, oh, okay, cool. And he literally said to me, is that okay? Do you know how to use that trackball? And I'm like, yeah, I love these things. I have one of them at home.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, done. You know, it's the little things that set you apart.
The relatability, man.
Yeah. The other thing too that he said, which nowadays, that's especially awesome. For younger kids, is probably something to think about. I was the only person that actually showed up in a suit for the first interview.
Very cool.
It was a very kind of more like chic, like entertainment, industry style suit.
It wasn't
like, FBI. But I remember it was like an all black suit with like this gold satin tie, But, I took it seriously enough where I went the extra mile and, dressed up, out of respect.
Yes.
And those two things were kind of, and I've been there now for almost 19 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
And so I was working there and doing a place called Home Thing for a little while. And then after a couple of years, I just got so busy at Megatracks that I had to let the A Place Called Home gig go. And I stopped teaching there. But, I love that place.
Since I've known you, you're incredibly busy over there. How did we meet? It was through Megatracks. I want to see who was. Wasn't it through?
I remember the way I remember it. Wilfredo Reyes Jr.
Wilfredo
recommended you.
That's right.
So Because he kept saying, man, do you know Michael Rapole? Do you know Nomad? Do you know Nomad? I'm like, no, man, I don't know.
Back then, I wasn't even Nomad.
Yeah. And he's like, you got to get this guy. You got to get this guy to record guitar for you.
Right.
And I'm like, okay. Yeah. And, you know, he kept saying, his big thing is acoustic guitars too, but he does electric as well and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And then we had something come up where we needed, I think it was acoustic guitars. Yes. And so I was like, hey, you know what? We should try this guy.
Yeah.
And that's when we brought you in.
That's right. Fantastic. So, good. See, yeah. I should have just asked you. You have the perfect memory. While Fredo Reyes Jr. is now playing percussion with Chicago.
I think so, yeah. He plays percussion with so many different people. I'm not sure. But
he plays percussion and drums amazingly. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, that's kind of one of the cool things about working at Megatrax. You know, he was one of the guys that we would hire to come in and play all the time.
That's right.
I mean, we've had, like, being a drummer, like, I always geek out on the drummers.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, I mean, we've had a lot of really big name drummers come through. Oh, just, you know, all the big guys like Vinny Caliuta and, you know, Greg Bissonette and Walfredo Reyes Jr. And, you know, just to sit there and, like, I'm setting up microphones on their drum set and I'm watching them play and I'm like, oh my God, everybody awesome. Would freak out with, you know, like a big artist, like, oh, you know, so and so is in the studio, Bon Jovi's coming in or whoever, you know, and I could care less about stuff like that. I'm like, oh my God, you know,
Vinny Caliuta's coming in.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so
J.R. Robinson.
Yeah. So, you know, you get these guys that come in and
very cool.
So that's kind of one of the fun things about working at Megatrax is, you know, we get the owners are musicians. And
that's
so,
you
know, the music comes first, especially in the music publishing industry now. There's a lot of companies that are owned by venture capital firms or investment bankers or corporations. And so, you know, the music is just a commodity that they push to make their money. But one of the things that I love about Megatrax is the music always comes first. You know, and, you know, we don't necessarily have to hire live musicians for everything. You're doing an EDM album. It's not like we have to start, you know, calling around to find live trumpet players, you know, for EDM. But if it makes sense to do it, we do it. That's one of the great things about working there.
That's what I love about you guys. You do hire everybody from a producer, programmer, DJ guy to the most incredible world-class musicians, like you said.
The thing that we try to do is we try to find the guys that do it for real, and then we try to hire them to come in and do it with us.
There you go.
So from the composers to the musicians, you know, and everything in between, arrangers, orchestrators, everybody. So that's kind of one of the fun things.
Tell us about some of the bigger projects that you've done that you're really proud of.
There's so many.
I know there's so many.
So just to put this in perspective, so I've been there for 18, almost 19 years. And I added it up the other day from the day that I got there until like a month or two ago. I've done over 700 albums. I think it was like 735 albums.
Oh, my goodness.
So the way we do it, we're kind of like a hybrid between...
Incredible.
A record label and, you know, like some musicians may be familiar with the more like royalty-free music libraries where, oh, hey, I've got 30 rock tracks. Let me just throw them up there and see if they make any money.
Sure.
We do targeted albums. So we talk to our clients and we focus our efforts on music that clients are going to want to use. And we package it in a way that makes it easy for them to find. So we make albums the way a record label would make an album or whatever. But it's targeted towards like, hey, we're going to do a sports rock album for sports channels. Hey, we're going to do, you know, music for TV commercials. So we do an album of, you know, music that's specifically geared for TV commercials. And it could be in a specific style. So, you know, we do albums just like a regular record label would. But we just do it on a scale that is not normal for most record labels.
It's much larger.
Yeah, last year, since we just finished out the year, I had to do a bunch of analytics on the production that we did last year and budgets and all this other stuff. We did 176 albums last year, or that I was directly responsible for. So one of the other things that we do too...
Wow.
Yeah, so we make our own music in-house. We call it in-house, where... Yeah. You know, we're in charge of it, we're overseeing it, we're producing it, but then we represent other companies as well as a what they call a sub-publisher. So, for example, there might be a music company in Germany, and they are doing their own thing in Germany, but they don't have any representation in the United States. So then they approach us, and we then represent them in the U.S. You know, there's another company.
That's brilliant.
There's a couple of companies in the U.K. that we represent here in the U.S. So on top of the 176 albums that we did in-house that is just ours, we also then represent all this other music from other people. So I think we do about... I want to say it's like 400 or 500 albums a year with all of the third party catalog.
And 165 of which you were responsible for last year.
176.
Now, 176. Yeah. Looking at the website here, by the way, it's megatracks.com. What I love about it, and you just said that, you're making specific projects. So they have a Valentine's Day playlist.
Yeah.
This is just on the top banner. The Sound of 2020 looks futuristic. Spring Break compilation here. Mardi Gras compilation. You know, happy hip hop compilation.
That's an interesting thing about hip hop. Hip hop nowadays is very dark.
Ah, yeah. So to go and do something with happy hip hop.
But dark, very cool. Dark, sad music
doesn't
really get people excited about anything. So TV commercials and TV shows, they're always asking like, do you have any like happy, upbeat hip hop music? And it's really hard to find. So that's why we put that together for them.
Immediately, I think of DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, right?
Yeah.
So he's trying to get more stuff like that.
Well, that we would call a retro.
That's retro.
So, I mean, basically what you're doing is you're trying to take some of the hip hop and trap sounds of today.
But then you're
doing a beat or a composition, if you want to call it, that's more faster tempo, more major key instead of minor key. Like Atlanta trap is kind of like the big thing, or has been the big thing for licensing. Music licensing always follows behind the Billboard trends,
right?
Usually by about a year, maybe anywhere from like 9 months to a year and a half. So something big will come out, you know, on the radio and on, you know, Spotify now, I guess.
And
after it's gained a certain amount of traction, that's when everybody in TV and film starts to say, that would be cool if I could put that, you know, I love that sound. We should do something like that in ours. So, and then that's kind of where we come in. But the funny thing is, a lot of the music that's written by artists, it doesn't really work that well in syncing to picture with dialogue going on top and all this other stuff. So that's kind of where we come in. You know, a lot of people used to look at music libraries as kind of like, oh, well, that's just like a cheap knockoff. But but now...
The quality is so good. It's not a knockoff.
I mean, especially for us with our studio.
Your state-of-the-art studio. But you know what I was going to say? I noticed that trend when the Black Keys came out. And then, like you say, maybe 9 to 12 months or so later... Every TV commercial had like a Black Keys sound-alike guitar riff and those old school drums. You know, it's like, it's so funny that you mentioned that. Yeah. That is spot on.
And now, too, record labels are starting to realize the power of just film and TV placements. License, you know, I remember hearing stories about Imagine Dragons. Imagine Dragons put on the map because of, I think they got a placement in a TV show and a placement on a TV commercial. Almost back to back within a few weeks of each other. And then all of a sudden, all the radio stations and, you know, all of the streaming services and stuff started getting emails and phone calls like, hey, do you have that group from that show or from that, you know, spot? And it put them on the map. You know, so there's a lot of power in doing music for visual media. And, you know, if you can write a track that works really well, there are phenomenal songs that just never work for placement in TV and film because maybe they're too distracting.
Expound on that. So if you have an artist that comes to you or a musician and you say, or you track them down, hey, create this project for me. What are some of the things that we might find? Now, for those who don't know, oftentimes you guys will administer a brief.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get a brief of what the client wants, what you're looking for. So what are some of the things that you tell the musician or artist that might not be on the brief or that are more nuanced? What do you, you know?
Well, and this is something that I talk about a lot when I do seminars and I speak at things. There's a couple of key things that you have to think about when you're writing music for licensing and TV and film, or even when you're playing on tracks for licensing and TV and film. And that is the cliche. the cliche is very important for what we do. We're not trying to break new ground. We're not trying to be the innovator. You know, nobody is coming to a music library to find the next new sound that nobody's ever heard
that's
before.
Right. That's right.
You know, I had this one guy I asked for. I don't remember his name, but I wouldn't say it anyway. But I remember I asked for I needed happy acoustic ukulele music. We've all heard that,
right.
You know, happy, yeah, yeah. You know, hand claps, yes. You know, maybe tambourine.
Very common, yeah. In commercials.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yep. And he sends me back these recordings that were kind of new agey jazz virtuoso type, playing ukulele with tons of reverb and delay on it.
Oh, wow.
Soloing over the entire thing with like these lush keyboard pads and, you know, some ambient percussion. And like, I could just see him as he's recording it, throwing his hair around with a fan blowing on him. And you know, I mean, it was the most epic ukulele I have ever heard before.
Like, you
in my
see
life.
It live in concert. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It almost sounded like he was using nylon string guitar. I mean, it was imagine like Yanni.
Wow.
Imagine Yanni on a ukulele. That's kind of what this
incredible.
Sounded like. And I mean, it was
like
insane.
It's virtuosic.
But yeah, I was virtuosic. Like, dude, I can't use this. Like, I need happy ukulele music.
Wow.
And then he kind of got all mad. Like, this is amazing. This is true art. Yeah. And it's like, well, dude,
that's not,
you know,
what we're doing,
yeah,
here. We're a very specific,
you know,
pitch.
Yeah, we are. It's almost like if a musician were to think about the sounds that they use when they create a song. You know, like, you have your different virtual instruments and the sounds in them. That is kind of what we are to people that make TV shows and TV commercials and films. We are one element that gets put together with other elements to make a final composite product.
Great analogy.
You know, and so you would never want, like, if you're a guitarist, you would never want a drum groove or a drum beat that just completely overshadows the guitar of your virtual instrument. And, you know, sometimes that's what happens with music when they put it up against picture and it's like, well, I can't even pay attention to what this guy is saying because this music is just so distracting.
Right.
And so, you know, not that it has to be boring, but you have to think of ways to keep it interesting without being so obtuse and, you know, in your face.
And I would say for anybody working with production music libraries, especially of your magnitude, be open, be pliable. Mm-hmm. A great example is the last project you and I just did together. You commissioned me for it.
Yep.
You said, I need some hybrid flamenco. You sent me about 5 or 6 actual audio references, said, this is what the client is looking for.
Yep.
Has to be all original, of course.
Yep.
I sent them in my first drafts because you said, do some drafts, send them to us.
Yep.
I sent them to Derek and you were great. You gave me very specific notes. You said, okay, this one needs to change this. It might be a little too happy here.
Yep.
Maybe work with the tempo. And then the second one, you gave me all those notes.
Yep.
I in turn went back and instead of saying, what? I can't believe this, man. Yeah. Who do you think you are?
This is my artistic genius, you know. Yeah.
I made the adjustments. Yeah. You came back. You said, yeah, I think that'll work, you know. Yeah. But we did a couple more little finishing touches. Bam, the project got done.
Absolutely.
So for those musicians out there looking to get into this line of work, you have to be pliable, easy to work with. You have to be able to take direction and follow instructions. Because like I said,
stick
they
to
give
cliches,
you the brief.
And that was the, my whole point.
Stick to the cliche.
Like if a company says, hey, you know, we need some Chicago blues tracks, don't try to do Chicago blues infused with some hip hop, infused with some funk. Because when you start to blur the lines for somebody that's trying to pick music for a scene that they're working on, say that, hey, I need some Chicago blues for this bar scene, you know, and it's, you know, like a roadhouse bar and people are drinking and whatever.
Right. And it might be a time piece.
And the characters walk in.
Right.
All of a sudden now they throw your piece underneath it and there's hip hop drums and it's like, it doesn't match the way anybody in the scene looks. It doesn't, you know, so, you know, you have to kind of think, within the cliches. Like, if I'm going to do an 80s rock album, I'm going to make it as 80s rock as I can. If I'm going to do a modern hip hop album, I'm going to try to make it as modern as I can. Like, if we're going to do a big band album, it's going to be 1940s, 1960s style big band. And, you know, we'll specify like, hey, we're looking for funk. What kind of funk? Well, we're looking for psychedelic funk, or we're looking for, you know, 60s James Brown funk, or we're looking for, you know, kind of the 90s, you know, electric funk, like, everything from like Herbie Hancock to Aquarium Rescue Unit and all those types of groups.
Oh, yes.
So, you know, like
AQR, I can't believe you pulled that out. I love those guys.
One of my favorite bands.
Colonel Bruce Hampton and the Aquarium Rescue Unit.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. O'Teal on bass, man.
O'Teal Burbage. Man, we need a high five on that one, dude.
I love those guys.
Now, that's some Musoid stuff. Yeah, I love that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I love how you guys are so specific.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And you have to be because, you know, you want to be able to hit the nail on the head because we make albums because we know there's a demand for them or we know there will be a demand for them. And so we want to make sure that it fits the need. So if we're too ambiguous, then the music's too ambiguous and then nobody can use it.
But see, you just said something very important. You know the demand. Your company does the market research.
Absolutely.
So you guys have a department devoted to that, right?
And that's one of the reasons why it can be beneficial. Like everybody always asks me, what's the difference between going with one of these online royalty-free places where I just put the music up, or going with like a bigger music publishing company or a smaller publishing company, or just doing it myself. That's the big thing I hear now. Well, why can't I just do it myself? Why can't I just do the licensing myself? And you can.
You don't have the relationships,
though. And one of the things I tell people is you should do everything. You know, in the music industry, you end up having five to 10 different careers to make one career. You have to be able to do everything. You should do everything. You should diversify. It's like your investment portfolio. You should never put all your eggs in one basket. But for us,
say that thought.
Okay.
Because one of my final questions is words of wisdom. And what you just said really is the wisest word of wisdom. Please say that again. That was fantastic.
Well, you have to diversify.
A career in music requires that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a career in music isn't just one thing. Like, I've gotten a lot of gigs by moving sideways.
That's right.
And, you know, a lot of other guys get gigs by moving sideways, too. Like, you might play guitar on something, and the bass player in the group, you're talking to him, and they find out that, oh, hey, you know, I, you know, am also an arranger, and he knows somebody that's looking for an arranger. Now you get an arranging gig, and you
producer,
keep,
yeah,
and, oh,
this.
You write music too? Yeah. Oh, well, dude, you know,
there
like
you
came in as a musician playing on stuff, and then you're like, yeah, dude, I write too, and
I'm
it's
a
like,
composer.
Dude, well, let me hire you to write some stuff. So, you know, you can kind of get gigs sideways, you know, by moving like horizontally or laterally instead of just moving straight up, And so even for me, on top of doing this stuff at Megatrax, I do a lot of freelance stuff, too. And I've been a dialogue editor and a re-recording mixer. Now I mix the score for several shows on Netflix with composers.
Wow.
So you know, you kind of move sideways, you know, and it keeps it interesting. It keeps it fun. It lets you do different things. So you're not you don't get bored from, you know, doing the same thing over and over again.
That's right.
But
sorry, I had to get that.
Yeah,
good stuff. Okay.
You want to diversify. One of the good things about going with one of the bigger companies in our industry, one of the bigger music libraries, is just the staff. And a lot of people don't realize the reach. Megatrax, for example, I think we have 12 or 15 licensing people. Their sole job is to wake up every morning and start calling every music supervisor, every TV company, every media and marketing department of every corporate company in actually all of the Americas. Megatrax is directly licensed in Central and South America as well, not just the US. So we have an office in Rio de Janeiro, we have an office in Bogota, Colombia, and then we've got several offices across the United States. But whereas most other music catalogs will have a sub-publisher represent them in Central America and South America, we represent ourselves
directly.
We have licensing people that speak that are Brazilian and speak Portuguese, and are from Central America that speak Spanish.
That's
and
right.
So, you know, we have one guy in Miami, and then we have a couple people in Texas and one person in San Diego, and they just canvass Central and South America for us.
Wow.
So, Yeah, so
the
coming to, and then we have sub publishers too in Europe and stuff. We're in about 70 countries worldwide. So when it's really funny. A composer that I know that I met when I went to London to record. Well, actually, I met him before that, but we finally met face to face, and I started hiring him to do albums. He did his first album for the catalog that we do called Track Distillery. And right. He has a Tunesat account where Tunesat uses fingerprinting like Shazam, and it monitors TV broadcasts to find the music that you've written. So you upload the tracks that you've written to Tunesat, and then it monitors all of the TV stations in your country and then tells you when it detects your music being used. And he had been using it for a couple of years, and he would get, you know, 10 detections, you know, 15 detections a month or whatever. And then our album came out here, and when we release it, we release it worldwide. So in we're represented with I believe it's Sony EMI in the UK where he lives, and they released it at almost simultaneously to us. Within a month, his Tunesat account was blown up, and he hit the limit because they have like tiered limits, like you know, like the $9.99 a month, you know, covers you for, you know, whatever it is, 500 detections, and then you know, you have to go up and up and up. And like within I think it was like within the first week that it came out, he just had so many. He literally emailed me and was like, I cannot believe how many it just came out. How did this happen? And it's, you know, we are a bigger company. We work with other bigger companies around the world. And we just have the staff, you know, for one person to try to do that themselves.
Oh, it's
ridiculous.
Impossible.
You know, but that doesn't mean that they shouldn't. You know, it's just there's certain albums that you focus on for, you know, if you're going to try to do licensing on your own, you have the albums that you keep for yourself, and you go around and maybe they're the more unique ones that are a little bit more artist driven. And you go around to the music supervisors and music directors and stuff like that yourself and try to pitch it. But
you try to get your own deals, drum up your own business, so to speak.
But coming to a bigger company like Megatrax, you have that weight behind you. You have all these people working your music. I mean, we have four people in the publishing department. We have, like I said, 12 or 15 licensing people. You know, we are just all pushing the music that we are releasing.
All the time.
All the time. And so it just elevates. It just all of a sudden you start to notice, hey, wow, you know, I'm getting thousands of uses every month. I'm getting tens of thousands of uses every month. And it just builds and builds over time.
The Career Musician Podcast is a member of the Pantheon Podcast Network, the first all music-based podcast collective. For more info, visit pantheonpodcasts.com.
Hi, I'm Derek Jones, Director of Production and Producer for Megatrax Production Music, and I am a career musician.
This is the Career Musician Podcast with your host, Nomad.
Let me ask you this. For the musician out there, the composer, artist, musician, who wants to get involved with a company like Megatrax, what's the best way to go about that? How do they actually reach you guys and present their material?
I am not going to lie. It is tough.
It is.
For a little while, we opened up solicitation just from anybody. I think we created an email address, submissions or something like that at Megatrax. And we were getting about, I think it was 100 or 100 to 150 submissions every day.
A day. That's incredible.
And while we have a big licensing staff, the publishing staff is only a couple people. It's like four people. Production wise, it's, you know, it's basically the two owners, me, and then an assistant engineer and a second engineer. So there's not a lot of us to look at this stuff. And then we have two music directors that do searches, and they kind of know the catalog inside and out. But to try and submit stuff, we just never had time to get through it all. Right. So I've always said this. You'll see me online or at conferences. I always say face-to-face is always the best way, unfortunately.
I say the same thing. It's relationships.
Yeah. You know, you can send emails, which are good. If if they get through and we see them and we can use them, great. A lot of times we get a lot of phenomenal music, but we just don't have a use for it right then.
Right.
And, you know, production cycles are cyclical. So it's like if we just came, like say you do the most amazing alternative rock.
Mm-hmm.
But we might have just come out with four alternative rock albums 2 months ago, and then you submit, and it's like, well, we just did four albums.
Right.
We need to focus on doing some jazz or some, you know, music for TV commercials. So we might not come back around to alternative rock for another 6 months, another year, another 12, you know, 16 months maybe. So sometimes it can be a timing thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it's just, oh, well, this is good, but it's not the exact type of alternative rock that we're looking for.
Right.
And with so many people trying to place music, it's hard sometimes to reply back because there's nobody, no matter what company you're talking about, there's usually never a person designated
for that
specifically to do that.
That's right.
It's always like, like me, like I'm responsible for overseeing the production process of all of these albums and make sure that they're moving forward and make sure that they're hitting the mark. Oh, and then also on top of that, you know, I have to I have to help with the publishing department, make sure that all the composer information is correct because I know the composers. The publishing department doesn't really know.
You have the relationships,
you
yes.
know? And then, you know, then I have to check. I have to work with the finance department because production spends a lot of the money of the company, and so then I'm, you know, so I have all these things that I'm doing, and then oh yeah, by the way, you also have to, you know, find new composers and talk to new composers. So I tell people all the time, you know, if you do email me, like if we meet and we talk and right. we exchange information and you email me and you don't hear from me, just ping me again.
Just do a little nudge. Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, I usually get between 100 and 200 emails every day in my inbox for work. And like, I just start from the top and I'm working my way down.
Yeah.
And there's usually, you know, catastrophes and fires that I have to deal with and put out. And so I may never get down through all of the emails for that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day starts.
And then they pile up. That's
right. And so, I, like, if you look at my inbox right now, if I logged in and looked at my inbox, I think I have about 4,000 unread emails in my inbox. No joke. So sometimes what happens is emails just fall through the cracks and I feel bad. I mean, like, literally, like, we could talk about doing an album and I'm like, yeah, man, totally, right? And I contract you. And then you send me the rough mixes for approval.
Right.
And 2 weeks goes by, 3 weeks goes by, and you're like,
what happened? Yeah.
You know, and then you email me again. I'm like, no, man, I never saw the email. So,
This is good information.
Yeah. So, and this happens with
everybody. Don't take offense to it. Yeah. Don't take it personal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just send back a friendly reminder. Hey, buddy, just checking up on the one I sent the other day. Yeah.
That's a big thing is following up with people.
Follow through.
just pinging people like, hey, what's going on? It's been a few months. Here, you know, I just did a new thing. Here's some new tracks that I did. You know, this is, you know, I just did some blues stuff and it just came out and it's really cool. I could do some for you, you know.
Coming
up with excuses to keep pinging people without being obnoxious, like, why aren't you responding to my emails? Why don't you love me anymore? You know,
this is the perfect segue because one of the talking points is business acumen. So you know, and within that falls, you know, staying in touch, following through. So
absolutely.
Great advice and insight.
Yeah, you always have to come up with ways to ping people. But if you don't hear back, don't take it personally. Mm-hmm. Just try them again. And try them again. And
be
then
persistent without being annoying.
Yeah.
And don't be rude.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of guys, a lot of composers, when I talk to them, it seems like they'll maybe try to target like one or two libraries. Okay, well, I'm going to try to get into these two libraries. And so I'm going to just keep sending them and only them stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like applying for a job. Like you want to try to find as many companies to send music to see what they're looking for, because you never know.
Sure.
You know, like when you are applying for a job, you don't go to one store or one company and hand in a resume and then wait to hear back and see if they and then when they finally do say no, then you go to the next one. You know, like you canvass, like you send out, you know,
canvassing.
And
that's
so
right.
you have to do that to some degree, because you never know. Like I said, alternative rock, we may have just finished doing alternative rock, but there may be another catalog that is now talking about doing alternative rock, and they're like, oh, this is perfect timing, you know. So you never know. You just have to keep sending stuff out there and find, you know, different companies to write for. The Production Music Association, PMA Music, they are phenomenal. Sorry about that.
No, if you have to grab a call, we can stop.
It was just telemarketing as usual. Okay. but I didn't know if the mic was picking up the little.
Gotcha.
Yeah. But the PMA, the Production Music Association, is phenomenal. They have a conference once a year in September called PMC. Production Music Conference. That's a great place to go.
It is.
Music libraries from around the U.S. and from Europe, and now some of them from Japan and stuff are starting to come to it.
Yeah.
It's a great way to just meet people. You never know who you're going to talk to. You're sitting there at the Starbucks having a coffee during the PMC, and you start talking to a buddy of mine. This is a really great story. A buddy of mine went to the first PMC, and afterwards they had like a little cocktail hour. And he is like a punk rock guy, like a alternative rock, punk rock, right?
Sure.
And he was in a band. He was actually the guitarist with Hole, with Courtney Love, and toured with her for a while and stuff like that. Great guy, amazing musician, amazing composer and songwriter and stuff too. And he had started doing albums for us. And I was like, dude, you should come to the PMC thing, you know?
Yeah.
You never know what's going to happen. So he's sitting there and he just gets a beer from the bar and he sits down, and this guy sits down next to him, older guy from the UK, and just within, two or three sentences, the guy from the UK is like, oh, all this new music is crap. Nobody knows how to make music, you know, like the old days. And he said, well, what kind of music do you like? And the guy's like, oh, well, I'm a big punk rock fan. And my buddy's like, me too, man. And they just had this huge conversation about punk rock for I think it was like 2 or 3 hours.
Wow.
And then the guy's like, what do you do? He's like, well, I write music, and I was in this band, and now I write music, and I write music for Megatrax. And he said, we have to meet. You need to come to my office. And he's like, well, who are you? He's like, oh, well, my name's Russell. I run Extreme Music, which is now Sony Production Music.
Oh, wow.
He was the CEO.
The CEO.
You know, and just happened to sit down next to him and started up a conversation. And then he said he went over to the office and hung out with him for like 4 hours and talked music. And all of a sudden now he's writing for them and for us, you know?
Wow.
So you never know what's going to happen. A lot of guys I know that go to the PMC, afterwards, within about 6 months, they're like, oh yeah, dude, now like I've got a bunch of libraries that I'm connected to and I'm working for and I'm writing for, and you know, it's great. So, but the tough thing for anybody that's looking to get into this is it's a longer game.
It is.
Because while some companies will pay money up front for the album, some don't. Some will do a revenue split, some won't. And
some take larger portion of the back end pie than others.
Yep. Yeah. But you know, you'll usually always get your writer's royalties as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'll get a split on the upfront money. But it takes a while to get the stuff out there and then find a use for it.
And so it takes a while to see your residuals.
Yeah. I usually tell people it usually takes about 2 or 3 years of actually really pursuing it to get it up and running. And
that's right.
A couple of guys that I know that have just recently gotten into it a few years ago, it's been about 2 years. After about 2 years of really focusing on it and doing it, that's when they really start to see some decent money.
That's right.
They're like, wow, you know, I could actually live off of this, you know, and really, you know, keep it going. So,
but it's like anything else. It takes consistency, dedication, like you said.
Is what you get out.
Exactly. You know? I find myself in that interesting purgatory kind of space now, where I'm seeing some good returns from it, but not enough to live off of because it's not my only focus.
Yep, absolutely.
If it were my only focus, I think I could get it to that point of pure sustainability.
Yep.
But it does take some sacrifice to get there. So it is kind of like you have to rob Peter to pay Paul when you're starting out.
Yeah.
So I guess the end game there is be patient, be persistent, be diligent.
Absolutely.
All of the cliches.
Yep. Diversify, you know? Try to write for as many different companies as you can. And that's one of the things that I tell people too is different companies have different fortes. They have different relationships with the same clients. So you never know, like, and this has happened before with us. Like, I've had guys that do a sports rock album for us. And they do a sports rock album for one of our competitors. And one of the guys will be like, oh, well, dude, my sports rock album with the other guy, with the other company, has made a ton of money. Right. And then the second guy is like, dude, I did a sports rock album for that exact same other company. It hasn't made any money, but I've made crazy money
from the ones that you did.
Yeah, so, you know, it's like, it's hard to tell.
It's a crapshoot.
What I tell people is, you know, try different companies and see which work for you. So, you know, usually maybe, but it's not like, hey, here's one song. Let me see if I make a lot of money from it.
That's what I always tell my friends. Yeah. It really is. I liken it to the penny stocks.
It is, yeah.
You have to put the content in. Yeah. Don't come to me with 10 Qs and say, I wrote 10 Qs. How come I haven't seen any money?
Yeah.
No, give me 1,000 Qs. Yeah. Then we'll talk. Start with 100.
Yeah.
You know, let's get 100, 150. Yep. Get your catalog. I usually say get your catalog to 300 Qs.
Yep.
And get them in circulation, and then you'll start seeing something.
Yeah, usually I tell people it's around 250 to 300 is where you actually start to see money. But what I tell people, too, is just maybe try to get 30 in one catalog, 30
that's
in another catalog,
that's
20
right.
or 30 in another catalog,
that's right.
and see if it starts to generate revenue. Yeah. You'll start to see, hey, you know, company X and Y, I'm doing pretty well with my 30 tracks in each one of them. Mm-hmm. Oh, but company Z, I'm not making any money from, mm-hmm. you know? So, okay, well, I'm going to keep trying to develop and give money to the ones that I'm making money from. And they will probably keep coming back to you to try to get money, to get music, because they're also making money. That's kind of one of the things. It's like when you make money, they make money. When they make money, you make money. So, it's like a symbiotic relationship. You know, that's kind of one of the things that I always tell people to try to focus on is just diversifying and put a little bit in mm-hmm. every catalog and see which ones start to do pretty well and try different stuff. Don't do like if you can do 10 jazz, 10 rock, 10 orchestral or country or whatever, that's better than just doing 30 of the same rock type of cues.
That's right.
Because if 10 tracks aren't going anywhere with that catalog for whatever reason, you know, the rest aren't going to if they're all the same type of thing. So trying
kind of like a probationary catalog to see what,
yeah, you know,
goes,
like,
right?
It's just, it's like your writing style. How does it match up with that catalog and the clients that that catalog has? So if I did, 70s funk and I did 10 tracks of 70s funk and then I did 10 tracks of like acoustic singer songwriter and then I did 10 tracks of like electronic EDM. Maybe the EDM tracks all of a sudden start to make a ton of money, but the other ones don't. Mm. Oh, okay. Well, let me try doing more electronic styles of music with that catalog.
That's
you know, but then you may have another catalog that you did 10 acoustic singer-songwriter tracks for that blew up, but the electronic tracks you did for them didn't make anything.
So you kind of play
the field. You know, a lot of guys tend to cling on to their music and they're like, man, I wrote these 10 amazing songs. I don't want to let go of them. You know, if
you learn to get over that,
if you can't, you know, this is like getting into doing what we do with this. This is like an industry. This is a career. So if you can only write 10 songs, then this isn't the industry for you. But
if
you can write 10 songs, you know, every week or every 2 weeks and different types of music, everybody has their forte. Like, don't ever, like, this is another piece of advice. Don't ever walk up to people and say, oh, yeah, I do everything.
Ugh.
I do everything well.
That is the
kiss
just,
of
death.
Know,
yes.
I wake up in the morning and I piss excellence, you know. When you say I can do everything, that doesn't help. Like, everybody has a forte. Everybody has something that they gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. Even if it's something that you like more, you know, put that foot forward.
That's
like when somebody asks, oh, hey, what do you, you know, what kind of music do you got? Do you normally write? Do you do? Oh, well, you know, I love everything. I try to do everything, but, you know, I always gravitate towards you know,
X.
Orchestral music, or I gravitate towards Latin music, or I gravitate towards, you know,
so true,
50s blues or whatever, you know, it could be anything, you know, rockabilly, you know, it could be anything.
It,
so,
you
know, kind of find what it is that you feel you excel at and put that foot forward. You can say I do other things too, but always have that forte. And don't be afraid to say, this is my forte. Some people may be looking for it. Other people may not. We just did a rockabilly album a couple weeks ago. And one of the guitarists that does all the 80s stuff for us, just talking to the owner of Megatrax, he's like, oh, yeah, man, I love rockabilly. I've got, and he started talking about like these rockabilly specific guitars that are like vintage. And all of a sudden the owner's like, man, why didn't I know this like a month ago? I would have brought you in to co-write the rockabilly stuff with me, right?
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it happens.
Yeah, you know, timing
is everything. But don't be afraid to put, you know, hey, well, this is like one of the fortes that I have, you know?
It's okay to have three,
yeah, because when you say, when you say you can do everything, then it's like, okay, well, we're going to Abbey Road in 6 months and we're looking for stuff that sounds like John Williams. And we're also doing a big band album that needs to sound like Frank Sinatra. And we're also doing a metal album that needs to sound like, you know, active
Animals as leaders.
Active rock on the radio right now. And we're doing a classic, you know, rock album that needs to sound like, you know, Bruce Springsteen. So, okay, you're going to do
all of them.
You're going to do them all, right?
And then watch that person shit a brick.
You know, and Latin music. Well, we need to do some Latin salsa music, you know.
Or some flamenco,
Flamenco, you know, like, okay, what did I get myself into, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Because
each style, each genre like that, especially the deeper ones, takes a lifetime to really get a hold of.
One of the big things that we've been doing a lot, because we have a lot of clients in Mexico, we've been doing a lot of Mexican styles of music. Cumbia, norteña, mariachi bolero. You know, and just come in and say, I do Latin music. Okay, cool. Well, we need, you know, we need like 10 norteñas and we need, you know, 10 bandas. You know, like Latin music means a lot of things to a lot of different people. You know, you need to be able to specify what it is that you actually, because literally we do everything from Tahitian log drumming through, you know, top 40 style pop songs. You know, and
please do not call me for Tahitian log drum.
Exactly. But that's the thing, you know, when you say, oh yeah, I do everything.
Right.
To me, that's everything.
That's a dangerous phrase.
You know? So, you know, know your strengths. You know, your strengths, know your weaknesses.
It's beautiful. All right. You ready? We're going to wrap this up.
Sure.
With 10 maybe or so, maybe rapid fire questions.
All right.
And I think I know the first one already, but I want I'm curious because you're like me, we're foodies. By the way, when you hang with Derek, he's going to take you to the best lunch spots this side of Texas.
We got to give a shout out to 786 Pizza.
786 Pizza.
Yeah.
You took me there last year. I was blown away.
Yeah, phenomenal.
Okay, so favorite food? Maybe favorite food as of late. Besides 786 Pizza.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, just, I guess lately it's just been
a frequent food.
Like maybe. Steak, like American, steak. Like filet mignon.
That sounds nice.
You know, just no frills, just
right there.
Done.
Love it.
You know, just cooked to perfection, nothing fancy.
Awesome. When you fly across across the pond, you have to go on those long flights. What do you do on the flight?
Usually I watch movies.
I love that.
So
I do the same.
I'm always doing research.
Yeah.
For what I do, I have to kind of try to know what trends are. So when I'm on the flights, it gives me a chance to, I mean, when you're on those flights, you end up watching three movies in a row. So you can kind of see, like, I'll pick a genre of film. Like, okay, well, you know, on this leg of the flight or on this leg of the trip, I'm going to just do dramatic films and films that I may never really want to pay to see, but they're all free, so I'm just gonna
soundtracks in your brain,
Know, and I'm always watching TV, I'm always, you know, listening, you know, trying to find, going to movies, I pay attention to the trailers a lot. A lot of money in movie trailers, and so I actually pay attention to the trailers sometimes more than I do the movie.
There you go.
So that's, I usually end up watching movies.
I love that. Dream collaboration, artist, musician, whatever.
It'd just be more of the same. I mean, I've gotten to work with a lot of my idols. You know, there's so many great guys that I've worked with. One of the things I'd love to be able to do is go back to London again and record more there. We didn't get to talk about it, but Megatrax sent me to London a few years ago, and we did three albums of orchestral music at Abbey Road Studio One. with a 70-piece orchestra. I'd love to go back to Abbey Road and record in Studio 2, which is the Beatles room. We've been talking about doing that, and it's been on again, off again, where it's like, yeah, we're going to do it. The scheduling may not work quite right with some of the musicians we want to use. Let's put it on hold. Now we're going to do it. Let's put it on hold. Now we're going to, so it keeps kind of flipping back and forth. But I'd love to do stuff like that.
That sounds fun.
You know, I've got friends in Nashville. I'd love to go to Nashville and work on some albums with them. And, I mean, just work on more albums with guys like you and Wally and, another good friend of mine, Jimmy Haslip. I love working with him.
Absolutely.
And, I'm really good friends with Matt and Greg Bissonette. And I love those guys coming in. It's like, I have my dream job. And what's crazy is the job I do now is exactly what I got my degree in 20 years ago.
That's incredible.
And
that's a rarity.
I wake up every morning and I get to go into a multi-million dollar studio, which we didn't even really talk about, but the studio at Megatrex is really big. It's one of like the classic studios. Bruce Hornsby recorded his first two albums there. Like, his big hit records were all recorded in that room. The Police worked in there. Don Henley worked in there. Like all these big artists worked in there. And then
it is such a cool room.
And then in the mid 90s, Megatrex took it over and now it's a private studio just for Megatrex. So, but I get to walk into this huge, it's like a, 24,000 cubic foot live room. And we have I think the square footage of the control room is like 700 feet. I get to walk in there every day and that's my office and I get to make music. It's a dream job. Sometimes, you get frustrated with the politics or just some of the extra stuff. Oh, I'm dealing with metadata spreadsheets or I'm dealing with financial spreadsheets and I have to track the money that we're spending and, I'm going to go over budget, but
spreadsheets, that's like a dirty word.
I would rather wake up and do this every day than anything else.
Because you could do spreadsheets for some company that sells office furniture.
I mean, I worked,
that's not fun.
I worked at a software company for 3 years before I moved out.
Well, there you go.
To LA. And so, I mean, I know the grind, and it's like, dude, I would much rather be doing this than anything else. So,
well, that's a blessing.
In terms of collaborations or dream, it's like I've already been able to do them all.
Love it,
and just do more of them.
I know I ask this all the time because I know as musicians, a lot of times we don't have hobbies. How do you spend your free time?
It's kind of funny. It's probably not really politically correct to say here, but for a long time, my hobby was music and my career was music.
Right.
And so I would literally spend 16 to 20 hours a day just working. And I just recently went through a divorce. And so I said to myself, I need to find some hobbies that are outside of work.
That's right.
Because in our profession, we sit in a dark room by ourselves most of the time, at least sound engineers, and producers, and we're editing music all by ourselves, and it's very isolating.
Yeah.
So I started exercising. So weightlifting is a hobby of mine.
Excellent.
I started hiking. That's a hobby of mine. And then one of the things that I've actually been really getting into recently, which here in California, like in other states, they're like, yeah, but here in California, everybody's like, oh my God. I've been getting into competitive marksmanship shooting. So handgun, rifle, shotgun a little bit, but I really like shooting rifles and handguns and trying to do it competitively. So I've been doing like amateur competitions.
That's
cool,
but that's a sport.
Yeah.
It's an actual sport.
Yeah.
So that's cool, man.
Yeah. So it's fun.
And that's a nice, well-rounded list of activities there.
Yeah. And then
very cool.
The next thing I want to start trying to do is like something like a martial art, like jiu-jitsu or something like that. But
nice.
We'll see. We'll see if I can get to that.
Nice. All right. Cook, take out, or go out?
Go out.
Go out. I kind of figured that with you. Mm-hmm. And you know a lot of good spots around town.
That's because I always go out to eat.
We have to go to another one. I can't wait. Libation of choice. Do you have a favorite cocktail, favorite beer, favorite wine?
I don't drink anymore just because as I get older,
it's probably smart.
It's rough on my body.
Yeah.
And trying to lift weights and everything. But when I did, my favorite beer was probably Guinness. Mm. Or actually, I like Sam Smith, their stout. Even though I'm Irish and I'll probably catch hell for this, I actually liked the English stout better than the Irish stout. But yeah, that would probably be when I used to drink hard alcohol, it was always like the fruity, girly drinks because, I never really liked the taste of alcohol. So I would drink something that I've got a sugar tooth, so it would always be like the sweet.
There you go.
It'd always be the sweet drinks, but
that's my wife. She likes all the sweet drinks. Yeah. I like the straight whiskey.
I could never do straight whiskey when I was drinking. I would always drink the frou-frou drinks.
That's awesome. Well, hey, wrapping it up.
Yep.
If you weren't a career musician, as I put it, but if you think about it, we do this as a living. Mm-hmm. We're career musicians. What would you do if you weren't doing this?
I don't know. You know,
it's a tough one.
I've thought about that a lot before I decided. When I was 15, I kind of really made the switch to go into music as a career. Mm. I started playing music when I was 11, and when I was 15, I got my first paying gig, and I played the Man of La Mancha musical. And this is back in like the late 80s, early 90s, when minimum wage in Massachusetts was $3.85 an hour, $3.85 an hour. I was making $25 an hour as a 15-year-old. And and I was like, okay, you know what, maybe there is something to this music thing, you know, maybe I should do it, because I knew how to read, and I, you know, I was playing in high school orchestra and everything, and you know, somebody just asked me if I could play percussion, if I knew how to read percussion parts and stuff, and I was like, yeah, and so I did like a local community theater version of Man of La Mancha, and made a lot of money off of it. They were paying for rehearsals. I'm so like, you guys pay for rehearsals too? Wow. What?
You're in the pit?
Yeah, I was in the pit. Yeah, down in front. And and it was me. And then there was a drummer who was a student at Berkeley at the time. And he was the first guy that said, man, you got to think about going to Berkeley. And I was like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I could afford it. And he's like, don't worry about it. You just got to go. You'll figure out a way to make it happen. And that's ultimately what I ended up doing.
That's what you did.
But yeah, so I don't know. I mean, before that, weirdly enough, I was really into the military. I wanted to fly jets, and I wanted to be a pilot. And the easiest or cheapest way to become a pilot was to go into the military.
And I could see you doing that because you're so technically oriented. Yeah. You know, you're very good with that.
Yeah. So before I really started to focus on music, my plan was to go into the Marine Corps, because if you go into the Air Force to fly jets, everybody goes to the Air Force to fly jets. And so very few people actually make it to the point where you can fly jets.
Really?
The Army doesn't have jets. They only have helicopters. Mm-hmm. But the Marine Corps has jets. But a lot of people that go into the Marine Corps don't necessarily go into the Marine Corps to fly. They're going in to be infantry or be, you know, logistics or whatever. And so you have a better chance, or you had a better chance of actually making it to flight school and becoming a jet pilot. Like in the Air Force, you can go in and become a pilot, but then you end up flying like, you know, propeller planes and stuff that you don't get to actually fly the jets. So, you know, that's why I was like, okay, if I go into the Marine Corps and I, you know, make it into flight school, there is a very, very high probability that I'll get to fly like fighter jets.
That's cool.
And have the cool, you know, have the cool job.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I really wanted to do that. And then, you know, as music took over and I was growing my hair long and playing in bands, and then all of a sudden I started to make crazy money for a 15-year-old.
That's
and,
right.
And that musical led to two other musicals, which, you know, so all of a sudden now, you know, I'm, you know, 16 years old and I've got gigs. I was actually getting my high school band director gigs.
Wow.
Because I was just getting so many gigs. That's why I was like, well, you know what? Maybe I should do this whole, you know, live musician playing thing. But then the sound engineering thing just kept calling me, and I kept pushing it off and saying, no, but I really want to play. Oh, but we need somebody to record. I'm like, okay, I'll record, but I really want to, you know. Yeah. And finally, I just embraced it and said, you know what, this seems like this is my calling. Everybody is calling me to record, but not everybody is calling me to play. So, and I just love being a part of the creative process.
Like you said, you have your dream job. So that's quite amazing. So,
and I love to create music. I love being in the studio.
Right.
And I just love to be a part of the creative process and help with the creative process and, you know, make music that people can listen to. It's a lot of fun.
That's incredible. Derek, you've been an amazing guest.
Oh, thanks for having me, man.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I appreciate having me here. It's an honor to be here with you and be on your podcast.
The goal of the Career Musician Podcast is to provide valuable insight aimed at supporting working musicians. Help us continue to provide you with new and engaging content by getting our ratings up. Please subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts.
I'm just a nomad, nowhere man, writing the songs in this one-man band. A nomad.
Hey, this is Nomad, host and creator of the Career Musician Podcast, and I am thoroughly stoked to be an official member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. Pantheon Podcast Network is the first of its kind as an all-music-based podcast collective. Please be sure to check us out at pantheonpodcast.com for more info.
My name is Damone Carter, a.k.a. Dem One.
And I'm Nate LeBlanc.
And we are two-thirds of the crew that hosts the Dad Bod Rap Pod.
Our third co-host is internationally acclaimed hip-hop writer David Ma.
As the name of the show suggests, Dad Bod Rap Pod is a podcast where men of a certain age discuss, debate, and dissect rap music.
While we are somewhat classicist in our tastes and grew up listening to hip-hop from the 80s until now, we are also interested in the music's present and future.
Over the past 115 episodes, we have interviewed rap legends like Prince Paul, Del the Funky Homo Sapien, Roxanne Shanté, Kool Keith, DJ Premier, and even the proto-rap group The Last Poets, just to name a few.
We also make it a point to talk to writers, commentators, and creatives shaping the genre. We've interviewed journalists and best-selling authors like Nathaniel Friedman, Jeff Weiss, Hanif Abdul-Rakib, and Adam Mansbach.
And as Nate mentioned, even though we are products of the 80s, 90s, we take time out to talk to some of the most important voices in rap today. Groups and individuals like Little Brother, Open Mike Eagle, Billy Woods, and Rap Ferrera. If you don't recognize any of those names, that's okay, because what we love most on this podcast is to introduce old school fans of rap music to new music that we know you will love. New episodes every week on Thursday. We are the Dad Bod Rap Pod.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.